then, my deep thanks to the John Dewey Foundation and the APA for the privilege of offering these recollections and reflections. The field of philosophy has changed much as I have lived my life outside and within it. I'm pleased to have been engaged in various of these changes. The areas with which I'm familiar and that I'll largely speak about are those of social and political philosophy and ethics. Growing up a third child with an older sister and brother who always knew more, ran faster, and got the jokes that puzzled me, I was fairly sure they were brighter, more attractive, and had more promising futures than I. When, 7 years later, I got a younger brother, I think I was mean to him and disdainful, though he claims to not remember it that way. Our overburdened mother mediated. All around us were nothing but fields and woods. The nearest other house was a mile away. So we learned to be resourceful, and I learned to like to be alone. I argued frequently with my father, who thought that traditions should be upheld. That something was a tradition seemed to me no merit. I went to college intending to be an architect, but in my first course in philosophy, I fell in love with this architecture of ideas. The slim volume of Plato's Euthyphro, Apology, and Crito was, I think, what drew me to philosophy. I loved thinking about the issues in these dialogues and engaging in their arguments, at least in my head, since I was too shy to do so in the classroom. Perhaps the idea that one could best one's opponents with better arguments, whether they knew it or not, was appealing. But then I became disillusioned with philosophy. It didn't seem possible at that time to deal within the field with the problems that really mattered, such as the absolute horrors of war and what we ought to be doing to avoid them. I had spent some time in Europe after my junior year in college and became moved by the effects of World War II in a way that I had not growing up in the US. From then on, this made me aware of the differences between actual lived experience and mere thinking about events and their issues. The prevailing view within philosophy when I was in college, at least as I saw it, was that philosophy could only deal with the meta-ethical questions, not those actually facing actual people. And as Barbara Herman described it in her Dewey lecture, quote, in mid-20th century meta-ethics, it was a piety that philosophy must stay away from preaching. The content of morality was not philosophy's portion. From where I got to later in my thinking, it seems incomprehensible that in the decades after World War II, with its millions of dead and displaced and maimed and traumatized, the moral outlook that became dominant because all the others seemed even less plausible was emotivism, with its denial of anything like moral truth or justifiability. Moral judgments were seen as little more than expressions of personal opinion or preference. It was philosophically respectable to analyze concepts, but not to advocate moral positions. So I became disillusioned with philosophy. It seemed clear to me that some opinions were clearly more justifiable than others. And philosophy seemed to be then like an academic game, an intellectual luxury. So after a year of graduate work in Europe and a grant, I abandoned philosophy for a decade. Another probably decisive reason I left philosophy was that I got married at age 20. My husband was a graduate student and I needed to earn an income for us to live on. Luckily, after a few uninteresting jobs, I got a job at a political magazine, which was interesting, though the work I did was mostly very lowly. But to my disappointment, I found it in the wider culture also at that time, and not just in philosophy. Moral discussion was seen as mere expression of personal opinion. It was acceptable to study people's views empirically with the lenses of psychology or political science or economics, but it was overwhelmingly thought that in the mantra of the day, there is no real right or wrong. So no positions were seen as really justified. Some people thought that sex before marriage was wrong, others that it was quite all right, and that's all that could really be said. That the issues of war and peace or of civil rights were not like sexual morality was not explored. People still expressed their preferences and took positions. The editor of the magazine I was working for certainly did. But the moral relativism of the culture undercut a lot of serious argument. I wrote a book of reportage on the moral relativism so widespread in the culture, and to my surprise and dismay, it was quite popular with conservatives and religious traditionalists who had never lost their convictions, however misguided. And that was a warning that I haven't forgotten on how one's arguments can be misused. Then I had a falling out with the magazine's editor. I disagreed with his position on a major issue of foreign policy and tried to persuade my colleagues that I was right, and this was seen as disloyalty. So I considered going back to philosophy. Opportunities for the advancement of women elsewhere were extremely limited, as they were also in college teaching, but the intellectual independence of academic life was deeply appealing. I wanted to write a book on the public interest. I had become convinced it was a highly important and meaningful concept, contrary to the prevailing view that this, like other moral concepts, was essentially just a label attached to policies or arrangements of which speakers approved. Since I'd come to realize that in the wider culture also, and not just within philosophy, moral positions were thought to be matters of mere opinion, and importantly, that this wider culture is highly influenced by the views worked out in academic inquiry, I no longer thought of philosophy as a mere game. I had come to see how inquiry and discussion everywhere about what we ought morally to be doing and how we ought morally to live our lives used the concepts and positions of philosophy. So I thought that if I went back to philosophy, I would not be abandoning the effort to deal with actual problems, but could contribute to influencing what was happening in the world indirectly through improving the philosophical assumptions influential beyond philosophy. As I see it now, all the other fields of inquiry are built on philosophical foundations. Like all metaphors, that of foundations should be questioned, but however we put it, we can see how other fields of inquiry use the assumptions and concepts that philosophy develops, assumptions about what we perceive, about what we can know, about what is real, about what has value, and about the norms that should guide us. And they use the concepts philosophy tries to clarify. So yes, the constructions of philosophy underlie almost everything else, and the wider society of actual politics and business and culture and the arts and the social and arts and social endeavor are influenced by philosophy and by all these other inquiries. This influence is not primarily in one direction, such that first philosophical ideas change and then everything else does. It's a continuous interaction. Without the women's movement, there would not be feminist philosophy. Without the civil rights and LGBT movements, there wouldn't be dealing with race and gender as philosophical topics and so on. But social movements also need ideas and concepts and assumptions, and philosophy should provide them. As I was deciding whether to go back to graduate school, these thoughts were not clear, but I had enough of a glimpse of them to decide to make the decision. I tried using decision theory, which was very popular at that time, but it was of little help because the reasons on both sides were so nearly equal. But somehow I did decide. So I went to Columbia and wrote my dissertation on the public interest, and this became my book on the public interest that was published in 1970. This may sound relatively smooth, but in fact it was extremely difficult. By the time I was a graduate student, I had two small children, no confidence, and a husband on beginner's wages. I received no financial aid for graduate study, but I did manage to get my degree, and luckily again, before very long, I got a job at Hunter College, which is part of the City University of New York, and I have been at CUNY ever since, teaching at Hunter and then at the Graduate Center. I've had a few visiting appointments with lighter teaching loads and a few grants to let me take time off for writing, but my life in philosophy has been tied to CUNY, and I'm thankful that it's a public university since I strongly support public higher education, and I'm deeply grateful that CUNY has allowed me to earn a decent income doing what I am truly interested in doing. In the meantime, as I was finishing my degree and starting my career in philosophy, philosophy was changing. Gradually, various events in the wider world led philosophers to engage again with the important moral issues of the times, the war in Vietnam, the civil rights movement, the women's movement, among others. In his Dewey lecture, Peter Peter Railton writes movingly about how the civil rights movement affected him as a teenager and college student and affected his philosophical work. And philosophy has remained engaged ever since, to the benefit of both philosophy and society, in my view. Let me offer an example of how philosophy was changing. When I was in graduate school in the late 1960s, speakers would come every week or so to give talks in the philosophy department. One time, a well-known British woman philosopher, one of the very few women philosophers that there were at the time, was scheduled to speak. A member of the department had jotted down on a piece of paper the title and topic of her talk and had left it for his colleagues. Who were responsible for putting up a notice, chairing the meeting, introducing her, and so on. But there was a serious problem. The handwriting on the professor's note, who had taken down something on the phone from the speaker, the handwriting on the note was very unclear, and the writer of the note couldn't be reached. So the members of the department were passing the note around, trying to decipher the handwriting to find out what the speaker would be talking about. A number of them said, it looked like abortion, the moral problem of abortion, but it couldn't be abortion, they all said, because that was not a philosophical topic. Well, the talk by Elizabeth Anscombe was indeed on abortion, and it gradually became acknowledged that, of course, the moral problems surrounding abortion are legitimate philosophical topics. Innumerable books and articles in philosophy have by now made it entirely obvious. But this illustrates the way philosophy has changed. It's now possible to deal philosophically with the real moral problems people face in their lives, and not only to deal with meta-ethics and the analysis of concepts. Around the time I was starting to teach, and shortly after I got my degree, a number of us in New York City, students and teachers of philosophy, were organizing to protest U.S. involvement in the war in Vietnam. Again, many senior philosophers did not think the issues were of philosophical interest, but we argued that they were and showed how the questions of when and how military force ought or ought not to be used, what the norms for international behavior ought to be, when civil disobedience might or might not be justified, and so on, are of course legitimate philosophical issues. The 1960s and 70s were a time of intense political divisions over especially the war in Vietnam. Many people were protesting and engaging in acts of civil disobedience. A substantial number of us in philosophy thought that we should be involved in these debates. A year ago, I went to the business meeting of the APA Eastern Division. I think that was in Baltimore, somewhere near Baltimore. And it was attended by only a handful of members, not part of the APA organization. But this was a sign of the relative acceptance of how the organization is operating. Today, the APA engages without outcry in activities that previously might have been opposed as political. But in the 60s and 70s, during the Vietnam War, APA business meetings drew hundreds of attendees and were highly contentious. Whether the APA should take political positions was angrily debated. Many members supported resolutions opposing U.S. involvement in the war in Vietnam, and resolutions were introduced on various political issues. Later, it was decided to submit resolutions to a mail ballot to assure better representation. Now, innumerable philosophy courses on campuses of every kind routinely discuss contested political and social matters. In the late 1960s in New York City, a group of us formed the Society for Philosophy and Public Affairs to discuss the questions involved in the war in Vietnam and other pressing issues of political morality. We met regularly. Two volumes of papers came out of these discussions, as Eva mentioned, Philosophy and Political Action and Philosophy, Morality, and International Affairs. And in 1971, John Rawls published A Theory of Justice. Other, more established philosophers than I started the journal Philosophy and Public Affairs, which became a kind of journal of Rawls studies. And so, from around the early 1970s on, it has been possible to deal within philosophy with the most important moral issues in public life. Justice became excessively emphasized over other values. possibly because of the reality of the systems of justice and law that determine so much, couldn't be ignored, and one can speculate their associations between justice and the tough and the masculine. But normative moral theory was again respectable in political philosophy, and then philosophy in general. The overemphasis on justice has continued, but more importantly, it became and has continued to be possible to deal within philosophy with the actual moral problems people cannot escape. The whole area of philosophy, often referred to as applied ethics, developed and has continued to do well. I reject the label applied ethics to describe what we ought to be doing in this area. It suggests an inquiry that is unidirectional. First, work out the moral theory, and then apply it to actual problems. So, proceed from the top down. A better method of moral inquiry, I am convinced, is to develop theory informed by practice, as well as practice informed by theory. I've written some chapters on this and don't have time to expand on it here. But the development of the ethics of care, which I will talk about soon, is a good example. We consider the dominant normative moral theories and how poorly they guide us in contexts of care. We look at actual practices of care, try to understand and theorize about the values involved and what they imply and recommend, and then think about how practices of all kinds might be improved in the light of these understandings and this theorizing. But back to the 1970s. For the first few decades of my employed life in philosophy, I worked in social and political philosophy. After publishing the book on the public interest, I edited a collection called Property, Profits, and Economic Justice. I always liked the title, but it went out of print very quickly. And I published my book, Rights and Goods, Justifying Social Action, which I should read as Rights and Goods, Justifying Social Action. And I worked with many others to change the field of philosophy so that we could address the real moral and social and political problems that people face. A large change that was occurring during this time in the society and in philosophy was the development of feminism and the growth of the women's movement. I remember giving my first paper at an APA meeting. It was at a Central Division meeting somewhere in the Midwest, probably in 69. But I've lost track of these details. What I remember clearly is that the meeting was well attended, probably because Alan Gewirth was chairing, with some 35 or 40 people there. There were exactly two women in the room, and I was one of them. This paper became, Can a Random Collection of Individuals Be Morally Responsible?, which was published, and it has been republished a few times. So philosophy is still not where it should be in terms of diversity, but it has become very much better in my lifetime. As the women's movement grew, a few of us women, there only were a few of us, started meeting separately as the Society for Philosophy, as the Society for Women in Philosophy, or SWIP, alongside the regular APA sessions. Other philosophers would often walk past the open door of the room where we were gathered with expressions on their faces of bemusement or disdain. I remember commenting on a talk in New York City in the mid-1970s and suggesting that the speaker's point might look somewhat different if women were included among the men it was about, when men was the term used for everyone. A chorus of groans rose from the audience at how annoying or inappropriate was the suggestion, but gradually, it did become recognized that we need to do more than change the pronouns. We need to think about what it would mean to treat women equally, for there to be justice for women, and so on. Among the questions raised at that time were, are women entitled to maternity leave? Should they be paid for housework? And so on. And by now, of course, the rethinking goes far beyond this kind of question. As society changed, so did philosophy. Discussions that had been all about men, stylistically and actually, started to try to include women. And as these questions developed about what our political and other theories would look like if we included women in them, we were often subtly changing the style of philosophical inquiry and debate. When I was starting out in philosophy, debates were conducted as gladiatorial contests with one loud, assertive white male philosopher hurling arguments at another loud, assertive white male philosopher, with the audience of mostly white male faculty and graduate students cheering on their favored side, though perhaps cheering quietly until at the receptions after the talks when their voices exploded. One of the things we few aspiring women in the field did as we started to organize and have our own meetings and discussions was to change these into quieter, more cooperative inquiries aimed at trying to find the best positions on the various issues. Our arguments could clash as much as in the standard debates, but we were not trying to demolish our opponents. And this change of style was often not the result of a conscious decision, but it did happen. Sometimes it has gone too far, and the quieter arguments are hard to hear. But for the most part, I think the change has improved philosophical discussion. In the wider society, meanwhile, dramatic changes were occurring as women entered the labor force in larger and larger numbers. The ranks of higher and professional education were gradually transformed as women went from being excluded or being a mere handful of students at law schools and medical schools and the like to being a substantial contingent. Women became newly visible in politics and the media, in the professions and in workplaces at all levels, and attention was newly paid to women's issues. The field of philosophy changed along with these developments. Gradually, it became acceptable, if not entirely standard, to include women in discussions of, say, rights and equality and justice. And then it gradually came to be understood that not only should women take part in doing philosophy along with men in the same ways it was already being done, but that it would be legitimate for those interested to also pursue what we can see as feminist philosophy. There was a lengthy debate on whether feminist philosophy really is philosophy, but enough of us thought it is to, in effect, bring it into being. I wrote various papers that became my book, Feminist Morality, Transforming Culture, Society, and Politics, which was published in 1993. And in that book, I was especially interested in how cultural change can produce social change, and this in turn can bring about political and legal change. The picture of justice reflected in law imposing moral requirements on us all is misleadingly static. Change for women was happening, along with change for others, members of racial minorities, LGBT communities, those damaged by colonialism, and so on. The idea that change can only occur through violent revolution was being disproved. New topics and approaches blossomed and have continued to yield important new insights and work. We started to pay attention to all the care work that women do and to recognize how relevant rather than irrelevant it was to our thinking about morality and society and justice. I edited the collection Justice and Care, Essential Readings in Feminist Ethics, and became more and more interested in the newly developing ethics of care. Eva Kate has shown persuasively how, quote, few, if any, political theories have focused on the consequences of dependency and dependency work because few, if any, political theories have seriously concerned themselves with the lives led by those persons, women, who have had to deal with inevitable dependencies. Since she wrote these words in Love's Labor, which came out in 1999, she and quite a few others have tried to show how the social contract, to be at all satisfactory, would have to deal with dependency and all the care work it requires. Dependency work is essential and should not be ignored. We cannot possibly have a just society until we figure out how care work should be handled in appropriate ways. Philosophy, the field, continued its march toward relevance. It became and has continued to be possible to deal within philosophy with problems of grave moral immediacy, with the problems people cannot escape in their actual lives. We now have in philosophy courses and books and articles on such topics as political violence, bioethics, justice and human rights, gender and racial justice, post-colonial outlooks, and so on. So we've changed the constructions of philosophy in this way, but there are deeper ways still, and they are ongoing. As women and others previously missing from philosophy now take part in it, this is not only more fair, with the members of these groups changing the feel of philosophy, as students can now identify with teachers in ways they couldn't before, and as philosophy takes up new topics previously ignored, it also changes philosophy fundamentally. Yes, the new participants change what philosophy pays attention to, what issues it deals with, but what continues to be of most interest to me in recent years is that it also changes the ideas and theories, the concepts and theoretical constructions of philosophy. It changes not only the topics to which existing theories, such as social contract theory or normative moral and political theories, are applied, it creates new theories. When my children were young, I thought their care and philosophy as I thought of their care and philosophy as irrelevant to each other and totally distinct. I think my professors and most philosophers at that time had a hard time imagining that a mother and a philosopher could be the same person. The concepts were just too disparate. So I kept my personal life out of philosophy. But very gradually, and I think it was my friend Sarah Ruddick, through conversations and her writings that helped me the most to see this, I came to understand the enormous relevance of childcare and other care work to what our thinking about morality should be like. Then I learned a great deal about care and its values from my children as they became parents and brought up their children. I became more and more interested in thinking about how gender has affected the construction of our moral and political theories, our most foundational thinking about how we ought to conduct our lives and organize our societies. I wrote about the ethics of care that was beginning to be developed and explored various of its aspects and implications. At first, I was largely describing this new way of thinking and looking at moral issues, but I became more and more convinced of the promise and persuasiveness of this new moral theory, and that became my book, The Ethics of Care, Personal, Political, and Global. That was in 2006. And I've continued to explore what I think is the great potential of care ethics. It ought, I believe, to transform our moral and social and political and economic thinking. It ought to transform how we see and make recommendations for international affairs and global concerns, as well as personal and political relations. It has the potential, I think, to offer new and better normative moral constructions throughout the multiple areas of human endeavor. In recent years, I've written various additional papers on care ethics that have tried to show why it's more promising than the dominant moral theories and than the over-concentration on justice for dealing with many pressing issues, including global problems. Although it was first developed and can often be understood most clearly in more personal contexts, such as those of family and friendship, it's increasingly understood that the values of care are of general import and that the ethics of care is of great relevance to and promise for the widest as well as the most personal of contexts. So I now see care as the most fundamental value, even more fundamental than justice, which has received so much attention. A lot of human life can go on and has gone on with very little justice exemplified, especially toward women and the members of groups considered inferior. But without an adequate enactment of the values of care, life cannot go on because there would be no persons. None of us would have survived infancy. The ethics of care is a whole new way of looking at moral issues, and it has deep implications for the social and political and other theories that ought to be influenced by moral commitments. The ethics of care is only a few decades old, hardly anything in the long life of moral theories, but it provides a genuine alternative to the dominant theories of Aristotelian virtue ethics, Kantian moral theory, and utilitarianism. And it is the first really new normative moral theory since the 19th century's development of utilitarianism. It comes, first of all, from paying attention to the previously ignored activities of women and others as they engage, as so many do for so much of their time, in the work of care, in handling human dependency. It comes from paying attention to the experience of women and men, girls and boys, as they provide and receive care, and paying attention to how they think and feel and reflect after the fact about the moral issues involved. And it suggests how, once the issues and values surrounding care are adequately thought about, perhaps we should rethink the moral issues everywhere else. For care ethics, the primary values are those that characterize good practices of care, such as responding to needs with sensitivity, empathetic understanding, and effectiveness, building relations of trust and mutual concern, and taking responsibility as appropriate for seeing that needs for care are met. These are very different moral considerations from those that have dominated discussion since philosophy turned its attention to actual problems and focused overwhelmingly on justice to address them. In contrast with the values associated with justice, which are fairness, impartiality, equality, which can be seen to be especially relevant to legal and political contexts, the ethics of care emphasizes the values of responsiveness to need, sensitivity, empathy, and trust. These are seen to be central not only to the more personal contexts of family and friendship, but to segments of society that have had much less influence in the development of moral theory, segments such as the education system and health care and welfare practices, traditionally associated with the female or the non-white. And the insights of the ethics of care are as fundamental and transformative importance to the development of comprehensive moral approaches and to questions concerning the global issues surrounding the legal and political structures of established nation states and their opponents. Actual care practices are often highly unsatisfactory and are embedded in morally indefensible gender hierarchies that permeate existing social structures. It is still possible to discern the values incorporated into even existing care practices and to understand how existing practices ought to be improved. We can develop more and more satisfactory appreciations of how care ought to be provided and received. And we can distinguish actual care and good care and delineate the characteristics of good care practices. The ethics of care understands persons as relational rather than as the self-sufficient individuals of traditional moral approaches, which are in many ways generalizations to the level of moral theory of views developed for the more legal and political and economic contexts of democratic capitalist states. Care ethics values caring relations between persons, not only within families, but in wider and wider contexts. Such relations will, of course, be weaker than in personal contexts, but relations with even distant strangers can be based on non-indifference. Persons can and ought to understand others with sensitivity and respond to their needs and aspirations. The understanding of care and its values must be developed as much from the point of view of the recipient of care as from the point of view of the provider. This enables good care to avoid being paternalistic. The initial concern some have expressed about this moral approach, that caregivers are often domineering and fail to adequately respect the individuality and autonomy and rights of recipients, misunderstands care ethics. Contrary to the concern of these critics, good care must provide care respectfully, and providers of good care learn how to do this. They engage in practices of receptivity, of listening, and being open to what recipients of care are experiencing. Being sensitive to the needs and feelings of recipients is essential for good care. So care ethics, as distinct from just care, should be built on the experience of not only providers of care, but also of recipients, which includes every one of us. At the same time, care is not just any kind of pampering, that the overprivileged may purchase, care responds to needs, which are not the same as wants or frivolous desires. Care is not benevolence or altruism, another misunderstanding that some have had. To think of the choices we face as either favoring oneself or favoring the other is a misconstrual of caring in many other contexts. Parents want their children to do well along with themselves, and those cared for want their caregivers to also do well. Caregivers need to also care for themselves and not merely for instrumental reasons. What is called for is cooperation rather than competition, mutual benefit rather than the pursuit of conflicting interests, and applying the values of care rather than of individual gains and losses or even individual justice offers promise for innumerable situations beyond the household. The caring person is someone who engages effectively and with appropriate intentions in good caring practices. Such practices could go all the way from caring for one's child or elderly parent to engaging in practices to end global poverty. But the focus of care ethics is on relations between persons, not the virtues of individuals. It's caring relations that should be responsive, considerate, trusting, and so on. Care ethics is not, then, a kind of virtue theory. Virtue theory, from Aristotle on, focuses on the virtues of individuals, while care ethics focuses on relations between persons. A good example is trust, which care ethics fosters and that we certainly need more of. Persons need trusting relations to develop properly, and healthy societies require an adequate level of trust. Trust must be a relation. A person who is trusting while others are not trustworthy just invites being taken advantage of. She's simply naive. But two persons can both be trustworthy, yet as individuals, they may remain without trust between them until a trusting relation has been developed. Trusting relations can be easily broken. They take extensive time and attention to build. Care ethics understands both the value of trust and how to promote it. And the traditional virtues of virtue theory turn out to be much more influenced by their specific cultures than has been acknowledged. In contrast, one of the greatest strengths of care ethics is that it is built on experience that really is universal, the experience of having been cared for, without which none of us would exist, and on the experience of providing care, which most people have had some experience with, and many people have had a great deal of experience with. Of course, the meaning of experience in all this is different from the narrow construal of experience in much epistemology as mere sensory reception or empirical observation, but its meaning is clear enough. The experience of receiving care is completely universal, and that of providing care is not limited to culture or region or social location. The individualism of much moral theory in the West, including virtue theory, make such theory less universally appealing than its proponents hope and intend. At the same time, the traditionalism of much moral theory elsewhere makes these alternatives less appealing than might be hoped by their adherents. The ethics of care, in contrast to both, can appeal to the experience and values of all persons everywhere, and all can contribute to its further development. Work in care ethics is being translated into many languages, and the values of care explored by this approach resonate with readers around the globe in very different cultures. Interest in care ethics continues to grow, and more people around the world participate in its development. And I find this growing interest, often far from its origin, especially hopeful. Everyone in every culture and society can reflect on the values inherent in care and on how the care they actually received or provided could and should have been better, and they can try to understand how societies should be better organized to provide care and to reflect its values. All can contribute to understanding how the values of care can and should be extended in society and the globe, and all can explore the implications of these values. Care ethics is not and does not need to be based on religious foundations. Underlying on the religious foundations underlying so many other moralities, foundations that can be highly divisive. Nor is it based on divisive traditional mores and practices. It's a feminist ethic. It's a feminist ethic open to everyone, everywhere, to develop. Another strength of care ethics is that in many ways it incorporates the best of the leading moral theories, Kantian ethics, utilitarianism, and virtue theory. While it shouldn't be interpreted as a version of any of these others, it can include many of their most persuasive aspects. Care ethics, for instance, appreciates the motives and intentions emphasized by Kantians in the performance of right actions. Caring actions can be understood to have the intrinsic moral worth emphasized by deontological moral theories. The intentions with which persons engage in care are of moral importance, and caring actions should be evaluated in part on the basis of the motives they express, as well as the effects they bring about. Other things equal, such as technical competence, it's better if a caregiver genuinely aims at the well-being of an elderly person in her care, rather than, for instance, aiming primarily to be named in his will. At the same time, effectiveness, as utilitarian and consequentialist theories emphasize, is of crucial importance in the ethics of care. It's not enough to intend to meet the needs of the person cared for. Good care must be evaluated in large part on whether it actually succeeds in contributing to health or growth or the other aims of care. So empirical findings about the actual effects of different components of caring practices are highly relevant. And finally, the ethics of care can incorporate various of the insights of virtue ethics in coming to understand the traits of character that should be fostered in the providing and receiving of care in caring relations. How am I doing? Ooh. Well, the growing attention being paid to care ethics in the first decades of the 21st century reminds me of the way interest in human rights grew and developed in the last quarter of the 20th century, and I'm old enough to have seen and participated in this development. At first, in around the 1970s, talk of human rights was dismissed by those with the dominant realist approaches as little more than moralistic chatter with no real influence. But there were increasingly extensive discussions of human rights among philosophers and political and legal theorists and activists, and human rights gradually became increasingly influential and important. This came to be reflected in actual laws and policies, and today human rights considerations carry real and very considerable weight in international affairs and national policies. In more recent decades, the ethics of care has similarly been increasingly developed by philosophers, political theorists, and other scholars and practitioners, and is becoming more and more widely influential. Its perspectives are by now regularly presented in volumes that attempt to cover a topic comprehensively, and new volumes of work exploring the implications of care ethics appear regularly. Many persons actually engaged in providing and receiving care through social services, healthcare, education, and the like, increasingly look to the ethics of care for insights and guidance. And many concerned with improving societies and their political arrangements are turning to care ethics for greater understanding and inspiration. So I expect the influence of care ethics to continue to increase. As I see it now, traditional moral theories are still important in their appropriate spheres, but these are limited domains. Justice and its implications are, of course, important and should be appropriately valued, but they are not the whole of morality, as has often been mistakenly thought, especially in recent years. And the same holds for individual interests. So I now see Kantian ethics as an expansion to the whole of morality, of the justice that may well be appropriate for law and the legal systems of states, but not for all moral and social issues. And I see utilitarianism and its individual interests as what may be appropriate for the political policies of governments, but again, not for all moral issues. I now see care ethics as the more comprehensive morality within which we should often employ the more traditional moral approaches for their respective limited domains. Within the wider and, yes, shallower network of caring relations in civil society, we should understand and develop legal systems guided more or less by Kantian norms emphasizing justice, equality, and individual rights, and political systems guided more or less by utilitarian norms promoting the general welfare. As I see it, the importance of justice, equality, and individual rights and interests can be recognized by the ethics of care in their appropriate domains, but these are limited spheres and should become even more so. Much of society and of human life lies outside them, and many of our most pressing moral problems are not best addressed from within them. From the point of view of the ethics of care, there should be transformations within the different domains of society as they become more caring. The law, for instance, should use more negotiation and reconciliation, less judgment and punishment. Although its enforcements would remain necessary for certain cases, its use of force could be reduced. But the major transformations that a caring society would bring about would be in the relations between the domains. Legal enforcements and political bargaining would be less dominant, and education, healthcare, social services, responsible economic activity, and the interactions of civil society would be vastly strengthened and improved and influential. I now see the ethics of care as the more comprehensive moral theory and caring relations as the appropriate way to understand and to evaluate both smaller groups such as in contexts of families and friendship and also wider entities such as societies and how they should be held together and states and how they should relate to one another. Care ethics is the wider morality within which we should forge our legal and political institutions and economic interactions. Of course, caring relations between fellow citizens will be vastly much weaker than those between family members, but they will not be non-existent. We have to care enough about our fellow citizens to care that their rights are respected and their political voices heard, or societies will fall apart. And then these ways of thinking can be extended to the global ethics, the global level. Care ethics has enormous potential to deal with the social and other issues that are so often thought of in terms of competing individual interests. Care encourages us to see issues differently. Clashing individual interests are not the right model for contexts of care. Of course, there are conflicts within families, but the deeper reality is one of mutual interest. Care fundamentally promotes cooperation rather than conflicts of interest. And this approach can be extended to all sorts of social contexts. I would hope it would be extended to much more economic activity than usually envisioned. Of course, conflicts are not going to magically disappear, either within families or societies, but we can move in the direction of cooperation and of recognition of underlying mutuality. And very importantly, we can move toward sharply reducing the use of violence everywhere, which the values of care obviously demand. Empirical work in recent years has shown how our legal and political institutions rest on a foundation of civil society and cannot work well without an adequate level of social trust and mutual concern. Care ethics would offer the needed support for this social concern. And the ethics of care has considerably greater promise in dealing with various problems not well handled by traditional moral and political theories tied to justice and individualism. Care ethics, for instance, can be far better at understanding groups and group conflicts and responsibilities, which have so often torn apart various societies. And it is more promising for motivating the policies needed. And care ethics has enormous promise for rethinking economic activity, both within states and globally. I anticipate major and ambitious new work exploring the implications of care ethics for how we ought to organize economic activity. I hope some of you will contribute to this work. And if any of you have written on this or know of work that has been done, please tell me about it. I would very much like to see it. What would the economy of a caring society look like? How would economic activity reflective of the values of care be organized? Consider how care demands that we be responsive to needs and that we take responsibility for doing so. That our most basic needs be met is far more fundamental than that they be met fairly, as responses to famines and climate disasters make clear. This understanding ought to be translated into our political and legal and economic and international institutions, which should first of all bring it about that the basic needs of all are met before they protect the property of the wealthy. A care perspective would also recognize the human need for satisfying work and not only for consumption. Lately, I've been thinking more and more about how incredibly and overly influential social contract theory, with its assumptions about individuals and their interests, has been in all sorts of fields and inquiries. And I think about how questionable that thinking is for thinking about society and economics and all of ethics. Although social contract thinking may be appropriate for limited legal and political contexts, it's not appropriate for much of what we do and ought to do. Increasingly, it seems clear that we should go beyond trying to fix the social contract and should instead explore the implications of drastically downgrading and shrinking it. Social contract thinking distorts, I think, our appropriate moral recommendations in much of society and the world, in our thinking about normative guidance and about where we ought to try to go and to bring society. The transformations needed are massive, and they should be towards the values of care, not contracts, however just or however hypothetical, based on individual interest. Increasingly, the relational values of care and its relational understanding of persons are coming to be seen as of global significance. Care ethics values of responding to need, of mutual sensitivity, of dealing with conflict nonviolently, and of fostering trust are clearly appropriate for a world looking for moral guidance. I've tried to show in various recent papers the potential of care ethics for dealing with violence, both large scale and small, and for supporting international law. And I've tried to show how it can better handle conflict and meeting our global responsibilities than can other theories. Consider how the ethics of care has greater promise than traditional moral theories for dealing with problems of violence. We need to think about how justice and violence are almost intertwined. Justice is tied to law, and law to enforcement, and violence may often be required in the enforcement of law. Moral law is supposed to be binding without violent enforcement, but as it becomes implemented in actual practice, violence is enlisted. The understanding of care and violence is different. Instead of abstract rational principles applied deductively and enforced through violence to the realms of politics and law, the ethics of care builds from the felt experience of caring work and practice. It extends the understanding of the values of care, seen and felt most clearly in small-scale practices, outward to political life, group conflicts, and global interactions. It understands human beings as vulnerable, dependent, and above all, interconnected. The effectiveness of care does not depend on the threat of force or violence, as it does with justice. Care must be built on trust, not fear, on sensitivity and responsiveness rather than rational calculation of advantage, whether of self or other or all. With the growth of care, one could realistically hope for the decline of violence. With the values and practices of care, violence is never to be used if it can be avoided, although the ethics of care is not a kind of pacifism. It can recognize that some violence may sometimes be better than any alternative available. But any use of violence is already evidence of failure that calls for new measures and practices. Violence should never be part of the everyday practice of care itself, as it is part of the everyday practice of justice. The ethics of care provides an even stronger grounding for condemning violence than do traditional moral theories. Violence is fundamentally antithetical to the values of care. But care approaches recognize that some violence is to be expected as an ordinary part of human life. Children do not become responsible adults without learning to deal with violence, their own and that of others. The ethics of care focuses on ways to reduce, deflect, curb, and prevent violence. Next, consider global poverty. What could be more of an affront to the values of care, of responding to need, of acting on empathy than that millions of children in the world still die every year because of poverty? Looking to legal institutions and individual rights may not be the approaches best suited to confront global poverty. Care ethics calls for a shift from thinking of responsibility in terms of holding people responsible for purposes of blame or punishment to taking responsibility for meeting needs that ought to be responded to. There are few more pressing needs than the needs of children in many parts of the globe dying in entirely preventable ways because of poverty. And there is no doubt whatsoever that wealthy countries have the resources to meet those needs. A calculation that has especially stayed with me is that if only half of what the top 1/20th of people in the world have gained in wealth over the recent period of globalization would have been distributed more fairly, that would have been sufficient to provide the world's poor an adequate standard of living. So the resources to end global poverty exist. Those with them ought to take responsibility for responding to the desperate needs of those without even the most basic needs to survive. This ought to be done through governmental and not just individual action, but governments should be guided here by basic considerations of care. Climate change is another huge issue on which the ethics of care can be more helpful than traditional theories. I haven't written on this myself, but others have. So, a major way in which philosophy has changed in my lifetime is that academic philosophy now deals with real problems and what we ought to do about them, problems such as climate change or global poverty or terrorism and political violence. Another way philosophy has changed is that the ethics of care has arisen. It's now taken seriously in and outside of philosophy and is reflected in major new volumes and conferences and talks. It continues to be further developed around the globe in ways I consider extremely promising. A focus on retributive justice represents huge moral progress in human affairs over yielding to desires for revenge, but this justice is still about the past, concerned with settling scores and righting wrongs. A focus on distributive justice, the focus that has characterized modern philosophy throughout most of my lifetime in it, is a judgment on the present and the fairness or not of its provisions. But it is still built on the social contract assumptions of conflicting individual interests and the legitimate use of violence, assumptions that distort our views of how morality should guide us. Care, in contrast, firmly draws us to look together to a better future. Thank you so much. Well, I guess
there is time for Q&A as long as we want. There's no time limit.